Tarragon's hug. I don't know whose recorder this is, but in several years' time you're going to hear this and laugh because you're going to remember me. But here we go. Good luck. The Tarra Talk. Mwaha. Let's have him. Etc. Very few double partials. Good luck. Here we go.
So when there's a Shanamu Baris, we've got a lot of extra weeks. So to fill in the extra weeks, we have very few double partials. But this week is one of our only double partials of the year because we have to get everything finished before Rosh Hashanah. So this week is Nitzavim Vayelech, and then the Shabbos right after Rosh Hashanah will be Hazinu, and then Yom Kippur is Shabbos. We don't have any more parshas of Shabbos, so we got to finish everything before Sukkot and Simchas Torah. So we got this phenomena that we haven't had too much of this year. Double parsha. It's lucky it's Nitzavim Vayelech. They're pretty short. It's better than Tazria Mitzara. But fewer Pesukim for the Baal Kriya. We'll talk a little bit about Nitzavim and a little bit about Vayelech. So Nitzavim begins. Very classic opening, probably resonates in many people's mind. Atem Nitzavim Hayom, source number one, Kulchem, Levnei Hashem Elokechem. You're all standing in front of Hashem. And keep in mind, this is, Zach, move forward a little bit, come, it's hard to project. Keep in mind, this is on the heels of the Tochacha. This is after the very, very frightening, horrific, nightmarish scenes we read about yesterday. And Moshe is reminding the people, you're standing together as a bris in front of our Kodesh Baruch Hu, but listen carefully. There's an iteration or a delineation which is very, very uncommon. Torah doesn't just say source number one, part Aleph, Atem Nitzavim Hayom Kulchem Lefnei Hashem Elokechem. But the Torah is very clear about who's standing. Kulchem means everyone, and everyone means all of us. Yet the Torah writes, Roshechem, no reading guys, no reading in the share. Roshechem, Shiftechem, Ziknechem, Shotrechem, Kol Esh Yisrael, leaders, common folk, elder people, enforcers, pasuk yud, tapchem, children, neshechem, women, gercha shebekerav machanecha, mechotei veitzecha atshuei v'imecha, even the underlings of society, even the slaves and servants and people that drew water and chopped wood, wherever they were, the Nesina maybe, the Givonim, historically, other people. What's happening in the beginning? Such a strange beginning. Most beginnings state the point. Okay, you have a bris with a Kodesh Baruch Hu, accept the bris. Atem Nitzavim Hayom Kulchem Lefnei Hashem Elokechem. So the two parts of this pasuk that require attention. One is the word Nitzavim, strange word. Nitzav, standing erect, straight, confident, balanced. Then there's a second part of the pasuk, everyone. Rashichem, Shiftichem, Ziknechem, Tapchem, Gercha, Nish. So Rashi comes in the first part of the pasuk. You think Rashi says that after all those klolos, and all the fear, and all the consequence, and all the punishment, and all the stakes of Parshas Kisavim. I mean, you saw what we read yesterday. You heard what we read, actually. You can't really see what we heard or what we read. So the text. You go crazy seeing the punishment you're subjected to. In the mornings, you'll wait for the evening. Maybe the evening will be respite. In the evening, you'll be so tormented that you'll just dream of the morning and the light and the security. So all of a sudden, religion can seem very overwhelming. It's just plagues and afflictions and suffering and consequences. And I can't stand this. And it's guilt and it's hardship and it's burden. So Moshe tells the people, you know what? Be men. Stand. Stand tall. I told you this early in the year. We once asked Rav Lichtenstein, how would you define religious success? He says you have to have the shoulders to bear the weight of religion without being crushed by it. So look at Rashi. Rashi says, source number base. Lama nismecha parshas nitzavim leklalos. Lefisha shashamu yisrael mea klalos. I heard 98 klalos from Moshe. Chutz mimem tes. In Bechukos, they had 49. Moshe doubles them up. So 49 and 98. Hariku pneyan. They got all scared. Miyuchala mobeilu. Who can take religion? It's all God just throwing thunderbolts. Hischa Moshe lefaisa. Moshe says, you know what? Two messages. First of all, there is a consequence to religion. You're standing in front of Hashem. There are consequences to your action. It's not just willy-nilly, cavalier, do what you want, put your best foot forward. You're dancing with the Rabboni Shalom. You have a historical mission. You're meant to have a role in this world. You're meant to achieve something. You're meant to live a challenged life. So learn to accept duty. Learn to accept responsibility. Learn to accept mission. But don't be overwhelmed by it. There's a glory to religion. And that glory and that redemptive nature comes from the fact that it's a Kadosh Baruch Hu, and that there is a duty that's so great. And you're not just playing with your kid brother or trying to do well in your 12th grade exam where you do your best. You're trying to learn a Kadosh Baruch Hu's Torah, like you started learning Torah the last couple of weeks intensely. And you're probably lost. Most of you are probably lost at sea. And hopefully the message that you're receiving at some level is it will get better, and it will get better. I'll talk about this a little bit later. But part of the message is because you're learning Hashem's Torah. That's because you're wrestling with Hashem's will and Hashem's mind. You're right, we could baby it and infantilize it and just give you a few nice ideas about religion and philosophy and the Messiah and what it means to be a Jew and call in fancy speakers and have chugim lace the entire day, but you're not really penetrating God's will. God's will is enormous. God's will is infinite. Every sugya you've learned these 2 weeks, you could spend a lifetime, I promise you. You could spend a lifetime studying everything you studied in one day. Because every tip of the iceberg is infinite, because it's God's will by definition. So do you want to wrestle with Hashem? Or do you want to be shielded from that and just condense religion into a few nice syllogisms and gefilte fish and tradition and how to make Kiddush Friday night? Seriously, or do you want to see religion in the true sense? It's going to be overwhelming. It's going to be overwhelming to the human mind. I'm overwhelmed. The Bronzing's overwhelmed. The more you learn, ironically, the more you're overwhelmed. Because you know what you don't know. 2.5 weeks have passed. I promise you, you're all bigger Amaratzim than when you began. So I have to spend 2.5 weeks in Gush to become an Amaratz. I was a big Amaratz before I started. The answer is, before you began, you didn't even know what you didn't know. You were an Amaratz about the fact that you're an Amaratz. Now you're starting to learn how little you know. Because when you're in high school, if you got 100 on the 2 blot of Gemara with the Tosfos, you were the top kid in the class, you gave yourself a lot of props. Wow, I'm great. Now you're seeing it's just a tip in the sea. It's just a drop in the sea. So you're becoming a Talmud Chacham about the fact that you're not. That's worth something. It's good to be informed about your ignorance. Because worse than ignorance is to be ignorant about your ignorance. Think you know something. Einstein was more aware of his limitations in physics than I'll ever be, because I know nothing about physics. I can't even tell you what I know, what I don't know. It's all just physics. It's all just equations to me. Einstein carved out a body of knowledge, and he could say, well, until this point, I just can't go beyond this point. I can't explain a black hole. I can't explain this phenomenon. But this is what I can explain, put into context. I can at least tell you what I don't know in Torah and put into context with what I do know. So religion is this challenge, and Torah studies this challenge, between not avoiding the largeness and the sweep of religion, the sense of duty, the infinity of Torah, seeing it real, not babying yourself, not deluding yourself into recreating religion in a way that's palatable to the human mind. And that's really a shade of paganism. Anytime religion is shrunken into human terms, just to make it more comfortable, more digestible, if that's what you really believe religion or Torah is, and there's no consequence, and there's no guilt, and there's a tone, there's a theme of paganism. I don't want to see religion real, I don't want to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu real, I just want to convert it into human convention, into human digestibility, into human accessibility. And that's paganism, that's down the road. You want to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu as true and as authentic as you can. You want to see Torah as true, and you want to realize HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a will, and when that will is disobeyed, there are consequences in this world, and there are consequences to the human being. But you can't let that become a guilt trip. You can't let it become overwhelming. You can't let that become devastating or depressing or despairing. And so much of religion is finding that balance between a sense of duty, a sense of mission, accepting it, having the shoulders to bear, but not becoming too overwhelmed by that guilt. And in a community or a society of modernity which has tried to eliminate guilt from the public discussion, don't feel guilty, it's not your fault, it's your babysitter's fault because she gave you dinner too late when she babysat and you became a mass murderer. Or it's your nanny's fault because she diapered you too tightly and you were just expressing your inner you. And that's what your psychologist will tell you, or at least mine tells me. If you're just expressing your inner self, then it's fine, it's natural, it's pure. Guilt is a very, very healthy. These are frames, these are phrases that I want you to become comfortable with. Duty. What is your duty in life? Life is not meant to be a life of luxury. Life is what is my duty? What are my responsibilities to my family? What are my responsibilities to my people? What are my responsibilities to my land? What are my responsibilities to my community? What are my responsibilities to my students? That ennobles me. I'm not living a selfish life. not living a laissez-faire life where I choose what I want based on convenience and I watch games all day and I enjoy my life all day because it makes me feel good about myself. I live for others. And those others have callings and expectations of me. And whether it means getting up in the middle of the night or sacrificing a convenient experience for something larger to serve some, that's what ennobles me. But then you can't live a life solely of duty. That becomes oppressive. That becomes constricting. And that's what you're here this year, to try to find that balance, to live duty well, and responsibility, and expectation, and from time to time to feel guilt. When you fail to live up to your expectation, it's a very healthy moment. When you feel, I slipped, I dropped the ball, I didn't live up, how can I change? Some of my deepest moments in life, when I knew I was most alive, was when I felt guilty and ashamed of who I was. I didn't fall into despair, I just felt like I'm not living up to my expectations of self, and how can I change? Otherwise, you just fall into a rut, and these ruts become permanent, and not only do you live a static life, you live a regressive life. You're always falling into the most convenient package, the most convenient way to lead your life, and don't live a life of convenience, a life of ideal. But on the other hand, duty can be overwhelming, and especially, you can't see religion as submitting yourself to some other world out there that's against who you are as a person. But Hashem wants you to be healthy as a person. Hashem wants you to have vast experience as a person. Hashem doesn't want you to destroy or annihilate yourself just for the sake of duty. And it's a very, very delicate psychological balance to be able to understand my overall, listen carefully, it's the best way I can say it for you, my overall mission in life is to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So that's my duty, that's my calling. But you know how I'm going to best serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu? By being healthy, by being balanced, by eating, by having friends, by being social, not feeling, because I'm duty-bound to Hashem, I'm going to shut myself down and take constant actions that annihilate or subvert my stability so I can serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You know I can serve Hashem? Being balanced, healthy, anchored, and driven. Because if you're balanced, healthy, and anchored, then you can be driven, then you can accomplish great things. So Moshe is trying to balance the Tocha. Tocha comes with expectations. These are our expectations. These are the consequences. These are the fallouts. This is the aftermath. It's difficult. Man up to it. But realize that you can stand and withstand it. It's not overwhelming. And I hope that's what you're finding somehow in yeshiva, where your experience is holistic. You're not just seeing a Rebbe in a class of 45 minutes. You're living with us. You're living with a community of people. We're walking around with smiles on our face. We don't feel like we're missing out on life. We're missing out on experiences. We're not monks in a monastery. We're raising families. We're living in homes. We're building communities. This is an organic talk. This is something that works. It works with life. It's not walking away from who you are. It's becoming a better you. You can build communities. You can have families. You can relax. You can joke. You can eat. It's all part of it. But there has to be a sense of duty. And that's why the parsha begins with Nitzavim. Stand. Don't be broken. Withstand it. But don't assume that it will overwhelm you either. You can take the burden. You can take the duty. Don't assume that it's all just the sense of it. It's a hard message, and I'm sure as the year goes on, you'll be thinking about this a lot. Where can I strike the balance between expressing myself and serving those duties? And I promise you that if you work hard enough, that will cease to be a clash. That will cease to be a contradiction. When you're young, it seems to be a contradiction. But the more you work and the more sincere you are, you reach the point where it's really not a contradiction. Well, if I'm a surgeon, you should think about Hashem every minute of your life. If I'm a surgeon, should I be thinking about Hashem? I hope not. I hope I'm thinking about which leg to cut open. If I'm driving a car, should I be thinking about Hashem? No, I should be careful not to hit pedestrians. If I'm teaching a Tosfos, should I be thinking about Hashem or should I be thinking about the logic in the Tosfos? So Shavis Hashem is my overall goal. That's what I want to do. I want to be, why do I choose this lifestyle? To be a responsible surgeon and help people, or to drive carefully and not injure people, or to study Tosfos, or to give chesed, whatever. Why do I choose that system of values? Because I want to be a servant of Hashem. But now within each value, when I'm doing chesed, I should be thinking about the person, not about Hashem. When I'm performing surgery, I think about the leg, not about Hashem. When I'm driving, so Shavis Hashem sets the context, sets the framework of what I choose. But then I choose and I pursue each and every one of those values and lead them and live them deeply. And all of a sudden I'm a servant of Hashem. And I know that to be a servant of Hashem, I need to have fun. To have a servant of Hashem, I need to exercise. Servant of Hashem, I need to have a healthy family life. Be servant of Hashem, I need to have friends. Servant of Hashem, I need to be intelligent. Servant of Hashem, everything that I would want, I still experience and pursue, but that's under a rubric of something a little bit larger. I'm doing this responsibly in order to be a better servant of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's the first message, or the first lesson of this pasuk. Okay? The second lesson in Pesach, as I said before, this list. What makes Judaism unique? One of the three or four, we'll talk about this again and again throughout the year. What makes Yiddishkeit unique? In Judaism, there is a very, very limited dichotomy between clergy and laymen. There has to be a clergy, there has to be a set of Kohanim and Levim who operate in the Beis HaMikdash. That's the situation for greater decorum, for special rules, and when you break those rules, as I said before, there are consequences. As a rule of life, the closer you are to the Shechina, the greater the consequences. And you either decide, because the consequences are too heavy, I don't want to be close to the Shechina, or you say, I want to be close to the Shechina, despite the consequences. Living in Israel isn't easy. Living in Israel, you put yourself in the line of terror, you put yourself in the face of terror and aggression and discrimination, economic hardship, but you tell yourself the reason that it's so difficult is not incidental, it's not Tanzania, it's not the Arctic Circle, it's the promised land, it's the land that every single nation wants, it's the land where history will end, it's the land of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's the Shaar HaShemayim. So I want to be close to the Shechina, and I know that living in Eretz Yisrael is going to bring challenges that living in Chutz Laaretz won't, but I take them gladly. Because I know that they're reflections of being close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The closer you are to the Eish, the more there's a chance you'll get incinerated by that Eish. But you either balk at that, as Esav did. We'll talk about this in Parshas Vayishlach. HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Esav, you can walk with Yaakov. Why did Esav separate from Yaakov? So Esav says, I don't want to pay back the Shtar Chov of living in Israel. I know it's the promised land, but I know that to live in Israel, Ger Yezer Acha Vavodim, I know that this is living history. And I'd rather live convenience. I'd rather live luxury. I'd rather live suburbia than live history. So he takes himself out of history and he moves to Edom. So it's not incidental that living in Israel carries consequences. You either make the choice you want to put yourself in play, or you want to stay on the sidelines. If you're in play, you may get injured. But at least you're part of the game, you're part of the process. But you may get injured. It's much safer to stay on the sidelines. So one of the major differences between Judaism and other religions, there's a clergy in Judaism, but it's very, very limited only to Mikdash. It does not extend to performance of religion, nor to study of religion. Said otherwise, listen carefully. In the Beis HaMikdash, there has to be a select group of people, of officers, to help officiate, because the rules are different, and the Tahara that must be maintained is unique. But outside of the Beis HaMikdash, and whatever is necessary to support that clergy that works in the Beis HaMikdash, there's absolutely no difference between a Jew and a Jew who has the title of Rabbi. You're going to have to answer the same questions in Shemayim that I'm going to have to answer. And you know what? I'm going to have to answer the same questions in Shemayim that you're going to have to answer. And there isn't a separate line in Shemayim for rabbis. And there isn't a separate Torah or a separate code or a separate study prerogative. Torah study is incumbent upon every Jew. Every male Jew, if you don't study Torah, you, not your parents who didn't have that exposure, if you don't study Torah at some level, repeatedly, with some routine, you're not a fully Orthodox Jew. You can't be. You have to be someone who aspires to fulfill every one of the 613 mitzvahs. And that's a mitzvah. I'm not talking about that. It's the unique mitzvah. And you're going to get to Shemayim, and Hashem's going to say, why didn't you study Torah? Then you say, well, I wasn't a rabbi. Hashem's going to start laughing at you. I guess you were a profession. And when I get to Shemayim, Hashem's going to ask me, why weren't you involved in communal chesed? And I'll say, because I was a rabbi. So that's not an answer. You have the same responsibility as everyone else. There's no compartmentalization. There's no levels. There's no difference. You have certain mitzvahs and I have certain mitzvahs. And that's what Nitzavim is trying to convey. Atem Nitzavim Hayom Kulchem. You're all standing here as equals. You could be a leader or a layman. You could be a man or a woman, an elder or a child. You're all standing in front of this bris with the same set of expectations, with the same set of demands. And to me, guys, this is one of the major transitions I want to occur this year in Yeshiva. To own religion. To own it. It's yours. It's not ours. It's not our Torah study. It's not our responsibility to build this land. It's not our responsibility. It's yours. It's your personal mission. It's your personal relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. A rabbi has more knowledge, so you consult with him about a psak. A rabbi knows the laws under a chuppah, so he's a traffic cop. He doesn't marry you. You marry your own wife, and you divorce Chas V'Shalom if you need to your own wife. We're not in charge of your halakhic experience. It's you and your personal relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And this is your year to develop it and to own it. And so often we take ourselves, we sideline ourselves. Okay, we're just the subjects of religion. It's the rabbis who are running religion. on so many levels. There's an old modern Orthodox trap 10, 20 years ago where they would defend their rabbi. My rabbi is a very, very Orthodox. My rabbi is a scholar. It's almost like bordering on hero worship. Not anymore, don't worry. We've swung to the other end of the extreme. My rabbi is great. My rabbi in the 40s and 50s. And it was a way of exonerating themselves from real religious challenge. I can do whatever I want. It was hard to be from in the 40s and 50s. I'm not accusing anyone. I'm just analyzing it. It was hard. My Zaidi, Alav HaShalom, told me that in the 20s and 30s in Baltimore, he would have to get a new job every single week because if he didn't show up for work on Shabbos on Saturday, you were fired. It was a six-day work week. Most Jews, well, my Zaidi, yeah. So some of you know that in America, Baltimore is a very, very Torah-oriented town. There's yeshivas and kollels and tens of thousands of from Jews. My Zaidi told me that in the big shul in Baltimore in 1919, he was a member of the big shul, he started a club. You know what he called the club? The Shomer Shabbos Club. You know how many people were in the club? A big shul. All the Jews that had emigrated from Europe. Three people were in the Shomer Shabbos Club. There were three people. This is the Orthodox shul. I'm not blaming anyone. But the more that you idolize my rabbi, no, it's not about your rabbi. It's about you. The brachos, the benching, the halacha, the Talmud Torah, the midos, the shmiras halacha, has nothing to do with your rabbi. You won't get up to, I can promise you, I don't know much about achris hayamim, I can promise you, Hashem will not ask you in Shemayim who your rebbe was, who your rabbi was, which is, I can promise you that. He won't ask you that question. He will look you dead in the eye and say, wait a second, tell me about your Talmud Torah. Tell me performance. Tell me about your Shemayim. I can promise you he's not going to ask you who your rebbe was. I can promise you he's not going to ask you what your Ashkafa was. Were you datim or miyacharedi? I can promise you Hashem could care less. He will ask you, how is your Shemayim? How is your Tefillah? How is your Midos? How is your Shmiras Halacha? There's one word in my family I don't let my kids use. I hate this word. I hate this word in general, and I hate it when it's applied to religion. It's a four-letter word.
Hate.
No, sometimes it's good to hate things. I just said I hate it. No. They. T-H-E-Y. There is no theys. It's you. What do they mean when they said? You know, no, Hashem said something in the Chazal, and you're part of Chazal. You're part of that Masar. You're an, what are you going to add to Torah? Not, of course, to change their statements. But there's a direct line between Eliezer and his shittos and you. And Hashem's waiting, like he waited for Eliezer to change the history of Torah, he's waiting for you. How are you going to change Torah? It could be a global change. It could be a family change. You're going to be the first Talmud Chacham in your family. You're going to be the second Talmud Chacham in your family. And reinforce it. It's not about theys. What do they mean? The second you say they, you're quitting yourself. You're putting yourself out of it. It's you. I don't like it in general because life is that way. You either feel empowered or disempowered. You either feel like you're just a pawn and the theys are in charge and you submit, or you feel that you're part of a community, you're part of a government, you're part of a state, but you're also influencing. You also make decisions. They is an extremely, extremely disempowering word when it's used about the institutions that shape our life. And I, not Chalil V'Chas in an arrogant or egocentric way, but it's you, it's part... That is such an important member coming to yeshiva and feeling that. I'm not listening to my Rebbe's Torah. I'm being trained to develop ideas in Torah, to develop a sugya, to read a Ritva, not just to hear what the Ritva says from ten Achronim who read him and know him. Okay, so they knew the Ritva better than me. That doesn't make a difference. I want to own the Ritva. I want to own the Torah. I want to learn to open any Sefer. Could you imagine in 6 months you can open any Sefer in the library and read it? I remember I had that wow moment. I said, well, I'm at the stage right now of the 6 or 7 months in yeshiva. I can open any sefer and start to tackle it. I'm not going to read it conversely. I'm not going to be able to run my way through it. But I don't have to sit there feeling there's this protocol of truth that they develop, and I have to decide how to submit myself. Not in a rebellious way, in a personal way. Of course, when you personalize Torah, it can become rebellious. Well, who do I care? I don't have to listen to the rabbi. I have to listen to Chazal. It's what I feel. That's the danger of personalizing Torah, making it authentic. That you're not submissive to authority. You have to find a way to both be creative and to personalize it, and at the same time accept Samchus Chachamim and Samchus Chazal. So Moshe Rabbeinu is saying, there's a bris. It's not a bris with them. And this bris is not just about day-to-day personal life. It's a bris about how Am Yisrael is. What's the future of Am Yisrael? The future of Am Yisrael. It's you. There's no Am Yisrael out there. It's you. You want Mashiach to come? It's not what's happening out there in Petach Tikva or out there in Haifa. It's what's happening in your world. So Hashem is saying, don't look to the Iskenim. You're here also. You're a Chotev Yitzech HaShev Mimecha. You're part of it. You're a Ger. You're part of it. You're an Isha. You're part of it. You're a child, you're part of it also. So that's the challenge for this year. Own it. Own your Avodas Hashem. Make it yours. Stop using they. Stop waiting for other people to teach Torah, to give the shiur. Stop waiting for people to tell you what's in Torah. I can give you a handbook and tell you what halachas we have to keep, and of course you have to accumulate that knowledge also. But how about learning and seeing how halacha evolves? Seeing how the Rishonim develop the logic, and how that logic, you're not learning halacha l'maisa now because you're learning gittins, it's not like we're going to look up the halachas, but and to see the start of the halachic process. This is the start. This is where it starts. When people say, what's the halacha about giving back land? I'll tell you from A till Z, from today until tomorrow, whether we should give back land. Of course, today's ridiculous because practically we're going to give back land. But I'm saying in theory, let's say that the Arabs begging to make peace with us, begging, saying we are really in love with the Jews and the state of Israel. It's laughable. But give back land and make peace. Is it us or a mutter? I refuse to answer that question because the Shulchan Aruch didn't discuss it. Neither did Chazal because they lived in Gaulah. So you can't articulate a cogent halachic position without the halachic tradition. There's no Gemara about it. There's no Rishonim about that. There's no Achronim about that. So it's just speculation. I can tell you ideologically what I believe, but I don't paskin a law of Nida ideologically. I don't paskin whether matzah is chametz or not ideologically. I look up the Rambam, I look up the Tosfos, I look up the Mechaber, I look up the Chassam Sofer, I look up the Yeshua, I look up the Mishneh Berurah. So you expect me to paskin without that tradition? I'm not talking about giving back land now. I'm just trying to illustrate that this is where it starts. It's a tradition. Halach isn't taken out of nowhere, out of the clear blue, and all of a sudden Mishneh Berurah paskins out of the blue. There's a long-standing tradition that it all comes from. So see it. Look inside of it. And stop putting yourself on the side. That's religious immaturity. Religious maturity is front and center. I have a responsibility to excel at religion. No rabbi is going to do it for me. It's my responsibility. It's my opportunity to personalize it. It's my relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Rabbis have immense halachic knowledge. I have to defer to their knowledge. If I'm smart, smart people know the limitations. Rabbis generally have good moral instruction. I want to listen to their moral instruction. Rabbis are good people to have around. Obviously very important. But it's not about my rabbi and the religion, and I study for a few years in Hebrew school and day school and modern Orthodox school. I go to yeshiva, I take my, and then I go off and, no, it's you. Live religion and excel at it. Yes, see, Tamar. Right, so I can tell you what I think, but I can't paskin. Anyone that would say it's usher to give back land, to me, is defacing halacha. I can tell you I think it's a bad idea, ideologically, messianically, politically. I can venture opinions, and if I'm a Torah personality, those opinions may have greater weight or lesser weight. I can't think security issues. You go to a Rebbe to ask, you go to a general to ask. But if the second I say it's usher, it's not just about giving back land. I can't tell you, if you come and tell me, Rebbe, is this considered lashon hara? Someone asked me on Friday, not someone in the yeshiva, is this considered lashon hara? Do you know how many lines in Shas deal with mapping out the laws of lashon hara? About 7 lines in Shas. 3 lines in Bava Basra and 5 lines in Erechim. Why didn't Chazal map out lashon hara? Because it's so context specific. You can't map out lashon hara like you can a lulav or a matzah or a sukkah. Depends upon what culture you live in. Depends upon what the body language is, what the language is, what the expectations are. There is no way to map out lashon hara. So the Gemara almost ignores it, and the Rishonim hardly deal with it, and that's why there is no way to paskin. The Chafetz Chaim was a hero. He said, you know what? After thousands of years of no halachic map, people are just becoming very, very neglectful and very, very laissez-faire. So I'm going to write a sefer to reestablish consciousness. But you think you can paskin? I'm just talking to Yitro, I'm not, but based on something the Chafetz Chaim wrote in 1890, what's considered lashon hara, what's not, and applied that psak in 2011 with television, internet, the whole game has changed, because if it's something that's public knowledge, it's no longer lashon hara. So the whole game changes in lashon hara. So I would never say it's aser. I would say it would inadvisable. Oh, certain things obviously are aser. If I go and tell 10 people secrets, but most things are not the glaring textbook cases of lashon hara. Yes, sir.
The attitude that you're outlining, would you say would you use the word proactive in that, or?
Proactive, I'd also like to be personalizing. Personalized religion. Don't see yourself as disempowered, because that's basically excusing yourself. It's just an excuse to take yourself out of responsibility. Well, who am I? Who am I? What am I? Who am I? Stop saying, who am I? You are the future of Torah. You are the future of Am Yisrael. We have a great year this year. We have 70 great guys. How many of you are going to get up and say, I want to be a Rebbe one day? How many of you are thinking in your back of your mind and saying, wait a second, why couldn't they have more rebbeim like this in high school? And why is my high school like this? And why is my high school like that? Why is my community like this? And if only more like Rosh, and only more like Eric and so. Okay, so stop complaining about things. Get up and make a difference. If it bothers you enough to complain about something, so get up and make a difference. Who's going to save you? Who's going to clean up your world if not you? Who's going to care about things? So take that passion and see yourself as empowered to do something. You could be a Rebbe one day. None of your Rebbeim started out massively ahead of you. Let's take a look at the end just to connect the dots, and then we'll go back to something else I wanted to talk about. One of the most beautiful psukim in this week's parsha, which also has a double-layered meaning. I want to talk about both layers. Moshe turns to Am Yisrael, and you can imagine Am Yisrael is terrified because we're about to lose Moshe. I mean, you can imagine losing Moshe Rabbeinu was the most traumatic vacuum ever to exist. I was at the Rav's Levaya, and when the Rav was in it, I couldn't imagine life going on without the Rav. Rabbi Schreiber showed me that there is a picture near the Machon. If you walk near the coffee of the Machon area of Rav Amital's Levaya, and he showed me that he and I are standing side, one in front of the other, carrying Rav Amital's body on the stretcher on the way to the grave. I remember that day, crying literally like a baby. Tears. I was inconsolable. I just couldn't stop crying on the way to Levaya. I just was walking around. I just couldn't function. I couldn't. How's my world going to continue? Could you imagine Moshe Rabbeinu's Nifta? Heavens are falling apart. The world is collapsing around you. So Moshe Rabbeinu calms them down. It's a beautiful pasuk. But again, it's a challenge. Source number three. It's not so far and hidden from you. It's not in the heavens. You can worry who's going to go up and get it for us. It's not across the sea. Last pasuk, beautiful word. It's so close. So we'll talk about two things in this. First of all, the Medrash. I'll paraphrase. There's a lot to talk about tonight. The Medrash, you can look at source number eight. Talks about two people that walk into a room. Imagine walking into the Gush Beis Medrash. Vaulted ceiling. So high up. And they see, and this is a Medrash that appears six or seven times in the Midrashim. But it's the same idea. And they see a piece of bread hanging from the ceiling. A loaf of bread. So the stupid person, the ksil, the disempowered person, says, that loaf of bread is so high, I'll never reach it. Too high for me to reach. What does the wise person say? Well, what does the wise person say? If you're a wise guy.
Someone got up there.
Someone put it up there. So there's got to be a way to climb up there. There's got to be a way to reach those heights because someone put it up there. So you're going to walk into the Gush Beis Medrash, Aleph Elul, Tavshinayin Aleph, as you did 2.5 weeks ago, and be blown away. Wow, look at that guy. Look at that guy. Look at that guy. Woe is me. Who am I? I'm nothing. I'm an inchworm. I'm an amoeba. I'm a paramecium. Or you could be honest with yourself. I'm trying to be honest with you. Some people here are really, really bright. Okay. Some rabbis here are really bright. I'm sure some guys in this room are. I'm really not that bright. This isn't false piety. You take a look at my acoustic exam. You take a look at my SATs. They're not off the charts. There's a cutting intellect, pure, raw intellect. Not even close. If I'm sitting in, every year I'm sitting in my shiur room, probably half the shiur smarter than me in raw intelligence. But success in Torah has little to do with raw. I mean, you have to have basic intelligence. It has a lot more to do with perseverance, a lot more to do with sweat than with inspiration, a lot more to do with how long you stay. Now, I've been in yeshiva close to 30 years in the yeshiva world. I've seen people that are brilliant, that don't put effort, they don't make it very far. I've seen people that are, you've got to be an intelligent person, but you're all at that level, and they really become something. It's just pushing and working and working and schwitzing and doing. So I can tell you, I didn't come into this yeshiva with unbelievable comprehensive, my last name isn't Lichtenstein or Soloveitchik or Sofer or whatever. I'm just an average Jew from Brooklyn, nothing big special, just came. And I came and said, I want to do something, I want to make something of it. I can tell you the same thing about some of the other events. I'm not going to embarrass this one or that one. Some that are, brilliant off the charts, they can... So it was just regular, normal guys. So he took religion and Talmud Torah seriously and took a public calling seriously and decided this is something important to us. So think about that. The next time you walk into the Beis Medrash and you're banging your head just to understand a line and tells us, woe is to me, woe is to me, stop saying woe is to me. Hashem doesn't want people that crawl up in the fetal position the second the religious challenge comes. But take it. This is why you're here, because you've been so successful until now. The stakes are higher. Now all of a sudden, you're not the top guy in the class amongst people who don't care about, or many who may not care as much as you do. Now all of a sudden, you're with your peers, you're with contemporaries, a lot of other people that are really talented and really driven. Okay, but you've succeeded at challenges in the past, so you'll succeed in the future. What's also beautiful about this pasuk is the last part of the section. Kikar v'lecha devar mi'od, v'ficho v'vavcha lasot. So whenever I give interviews in the States, I'm always asked, what type of yeshiva should I choose? Should I choose the yeshiva that gives me the skills to learn or the love of learning? Skills or love? Skills or love? Now that question may be flawed. I don't know how this yeshiva has seen, but you know, I would hope that our primary goal is to give you love, not skills. But I don't know why they're asking me that question. Well, let's just not personalize it to a specific yeshiva. This pasuk reminds you of a very, very important interdependency. You can't isolate skills and love. If you don't have the skills to study Torah, then I don't care how much you say you love it, you're never seeing the heart, you're never seeing the kishkiz, you're never seeing the Ratzon Hashem. You may be shaking, there may be a fervence, there may be a piety, you may know this is important, you may take it as an article of faith from your babe and learn and bang out the blood and sin. But until you see this as the Ratzon of Hashem, there's nothing more eternal and more infinite than understanding one cell of Hashem's Ratzon. Nothing in this world is eternal. Not the secular world, not the pedestrian world, not even mitzvahs. There's no lulav in Olam Haba, there's no tefillin in Olam Haba, there's no matzah, there's no shofar in Olam Haba, there's no mitzvahs in Olam Haba, there's no chesed in Olam Haba, there's no tikkun olam in Olam Haba, because the world is perfect. Nothing that you subscribe to in this world is eternal. Everything fades. I'm not saying it therefore is insignificant. But the only taste of Olam Haba, the only experience in this world that you will extend and you will perpetuate in Olam Haba is Torah, because it's the Ratzon of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and it hovers above history and above time. It also is imminent in time, but it's beyond time. Torah Kadmali Olam HaPayim Shai was created before the world even was thought of, was conceived. So until you really see it, and it's hard to see it, because until you work, you just see details. What do I care whether he writes Chutz in a Get, or Tanai in a Get, or he gives a Get this way, gives a Get that way? This is what I'm coming to yeshiva to study. It's supposed to be studying about God and Jewish history and faith and messianism and theology, and those are all important also. But this is, everything is a hieroglyph. Well, how does Hashem define Gerushin? So it's made up of 10 million details, all of which taken together will give you how Hashem defines Gerushin, and by extension or inversion, how Hashem defines marriage, and by extension, how Hashem defines relationships. It's all just seeing Hashem's Ratzon, seeing Hashem's will. So until you have the skills, your love is professed. Your love is shallow. Your love is important, but it's not the deep love of this is Hashem's Ratzon. This is Kihein Chayenu V'Arich Yameinu. It's this world that Arich Yameinu always means Olam Haba. The day of Arich Arichus Yam, Yom Shekulo Arich. Kihein Chayenu V'Arich Yameinu. But the converse is also true. If you don't love Torah, you won't have the skills, what I said before. Skills aren't something you just acquire in a relaxed sense. You have to love it and be passionate about it, be committed to it, and work hard. It's Elul, guys. Don't listen to them about this. Everyone close your ears, okay? Don't listen. This isn't for Elul. But I'm planning to see that at some point, you may want to pursue. Push yourself. The worst thing, I used to work in Yeshivat HaKotel, the old Yeshivat HaKotel for Rabina. And Rabina would have this line, and those of you who know Rabina know he could be very caustic and very... He would say, you know when the... I don't want to say you know when the yeshiva ends, he said, and he said, he's very, very keen. You know when the yeshiva ends, he would say, the second you step off the plane. What do you mean? That's when the year begins. But the second you step off the plane, you're given your schedule, you're given your handbook, you're given where to have to be, when to say to begin, when to say to end, in Shabbos, out Shabbos, rules, night Seder ends, break, lunch. That's when you should want to follow a program. That's high school, that's college. You're here to relentlessly pursue Avodas Hashem. Everything is just a framework and a platform and a set of recommendations on how to ease into it. You're here with your books and your requirements so you can follow the rules? That's what you want out of your year in Israel? To follow the rules? It's ridiculous. It's infantile. This is your 1 year in the Beis Hashem, guys. Your 1 year in the Beis Hashem. When guys come over and start asking me the question around December time, should I stay Shonabed? Should I not stay Shonabed? My parents, my college, my this... So you know what? Let's just time to get some perspective. Okay? Your grandparents I mean, your four or five doras before are looking down in Shemayim and crying about this conversation. Because 200 years ago, everyone spent 15 years studying Torah until they went out and sold shmatas or, you know, with their little wheelbarrow. Because that was understood. That was the world they lived in. And now because of modernity, and because of education and enfranchisement, and things that are good, and we're happy they exist. Unfortunately, I'm not blaming anyone. There's no criminal here. There's no one person that made this change. But unfortunately, the world you live in has kept you to one, and maybe two, and if you're really, really successful, lucky, and have parents that are crazy, 3 years. Maybe. Unless you run away like I did. Then you can spend the rest of your life on the sheep. I'm not telling you what you should do, but just, you know, reality check. A reality check. Okay, so let's forget that conversation. You have your 1 year in the base medrash. You say every day twice, Shifti b'beis Hashem, kol yimechayef. I had a dream. If my dream came true, I would be in the house of Hashem my whole life. But there's a world out there. A world with disease, and a world of parnasa, and a world of family, and a world that's got to be part of it. But this is where I'd want to be, in a perfect world. Let's take the arch datilumi, or if you want to call it modern orthodox, and they're not the same, but let's take the arch modern orthodox position. There's a world out there, you want to be part, you want to converse with the Akiva, you want a big world out there. But everyone admits that in the ideal sense, Shifti b'beis Hashem, that's where you should be. So this is that 1 year to taste utopia, that 1 year to live life the way it could be in a perfect world. And you're gonna shrink into a coward? Say, well, it's just about the schedule, now I'm free. So I'm not supposed to be learning now. Now, why shouldn't you listen to this during Elul? Because Elul is a time of acclimation. If you push yourself too hard, you're not going to get your sea legs. But at some point in the year, define the schedule. At some point in the year, say, hey, maybe I should be learning a little bit during the break. I know it sounds blasphemous, sounds heretical, sounds crazy, asinine, lunatic, preposterous, off the wall, ridiculous, say whatever. That's when at some point an older guy came over to me when I shut up and said, why don't you learn during the break? I'm like, that's you crazy, are you preposterous, are you an idiot, are you stupid? And so let me try it a little. I did it one day, I wasn't so tired, all of a sudden, well, that's so crazy. Or learn for a Matzei Shabbos, come back real, what are you crazy, Matzei Shabbos, that's hey, nuts. Friday afternoon, Shabbos afternoon, man, she was all the. But that's what you're here for. When I'm on, when I'm off. That's how you live your life on and off, on and off, on and off. You're a slave to people's expectations or basic general guidelines that are meant to create popular structures that are good for frameworks but terrible for excellence. That's the road to mediocrity. You follow the rules, you'll be mediocre. You follow the rules and then you push the rules, then you'll be excellent. That's true in any sphere. Anyone that works out, here's a schedule. We'd be on a soccer team, football team, whatever. Here's the schedule. You have to be at work. And who are the people that really, really do well? The people that are there till all hours of the night, shooting, practicing, running. Sure, in any sphere. You want to be excellent, push yourself. So Moshe says, you want to be Kohen Torah. It's not skills or passion. It's beficha or levavcha. Beficha means your mouth, your articulation, your intellect. Levavcha means your heart, your passion. You got to have both. And Baruch Hashem, you're in a yeshiva that really tries to do both. I can't imagine a yeshiva that does skills better than this one. But that's not our message. You become skilled. We hope you see, and I'm sure you see in your Rebbeim, the skills that we possess, and the skills, it makes us feel in love with this. This is something we're driven towards. This is something we are committed to. And how can you pick up that double package? How can you say, I'm going to be someone who studies Torah his whole life. And I'm going to do it in a deep fashion. We're going to use those skills, not that you'll become a Rebbe. You can use skills today in so many ways, not just your own personal learning. You don't have to look any further than Elie Weber. Every time he stands in front of you, you have a walking, talking example of something you can aim for, even if Chas V'Shalom, you don't all become Rebbe's in Gush. There's a guy that wasn't a Rebbe in Gush for 25 years, he wasn't a Rebbe anywhere, he was a lawyer, he gave high-level shiurim in his shul, in his community, who's an example of a Torah personality. I have friends. There are Rebbes of yours, I'm not going to say him to embarrass them, who got their start in learning by friends of mine, not who were Rebbeim, but who were just Balabatim in the local shuls, who gave Shiurim Shabbos afternoon and excited them about Torah when they were 12 years old, who gathered them together. I have a friend, Natina, who's been a corporate lawyer for 35 years, for the last 25 years, maybe even more, Shabbos afternoon, he gathers all the high school kids between Mincha Marv and he teaches them Lambdas. And he's more responsible for Talmidim that have been to Grosh that are now Rebbe's of yours. That's how successful they've been than we are. Because he got them into learning at a young age. And that's really the only way to get people learning. Right now, we're trying to play catch up. The way to really get people into learning is to do it when you're young, to make it part of your dishes. That's really the way to do it. If you guys want to have a challenge, maybe rescue your children from the tragedy that you're trying to resolve right now. It's a tragedy that right now you have to sit 5, 6, 7 hours just to read a line of Tosfos. It's not your fault, it's not your parents' fault. Part of maturity means accepting who you are, being confident, but just being able to be honest. Be honest. It's not a tragedy that you can read the New York Times conversely or the London Gazette, or you can read whatever you want conversely, everything around, but a Tosfos takes you 4 hours. That's a tragedy. And now you're playing catch up and it's frustrating. It's going to get more frustrating. So could you imagine if you turn to your son and say, this is my gift to you, or to your family? That's something to strive for. That's a dream. That's a vision. That's a vision I had. I finish a Seder of Shas with each of my children by their bar mitzvah. You know, I'm not going to give them an iPod or a fancy gift. I give them that also. eBay. But I give them a shot, and I'm helping them. I'm giving them their Shabbos Seder as best as I can. And obviously, they'll be their own people. They'll make their own choices. Finally, just to keep the theme of Torah alive, one of my favorite psukim in Parshas Kisavah. My favorite psukim in the Torah. Because Kisavah was very dreary. And Jewish history sometimes seems very dreary. And the last 2,000 years of Jewish history have been more or less dreary. And certainly the last century or the last generation, we went through something dreary. Because we're living in Golos, and we're living distant from Hashem's revelation. So Hashem tells us, Pasuk, Source 5, you have all the tzaros and all the hardships and all the difficulties and all the challenges. The Torah will bear testimony that you're still the chosen people, that I'm still there for you. Because Torah will never be forgotten. There are two ways to read this pasuk. I want everyone to listen carefully. One way to read the pasuk is the Torah will bear testimony that you're still the chosen people. What is the source of the testimony? What's the proof that you're still chosen? What's the proof that Judaism is still alive? Whatever is written in the Torah, that's not this pasuk description. And then the pasuk says, and by the way, Torah is eternal, it will never be forgotten, people will always study Torah, so that testimony is everlasting. So read the pasuk the first way again. Things will befall you, Cyrus will occur, UN votes, riots, Turkey, Egypt, Hezbollah, Hamas, Holocaust, you won't make sense of it, you'll suffer challenges of faith, don't worry! Look to the Torah for an answer. What am I supposed to look to? Maybe Har Sinai, maybe Akedah Yitzchak, maybe Bris Ben Absarim, maybe Yam Suf, Yitzias Mitzrayim, and then the pasuk continues, again, the end of line number one, Kilos Yishachach Bizarro, because Torah will never be forgotten, so don't worry. That testimony, whatever that testimony is, Har Sinai, Akedah, whatever, will always be available. People always study Torah. This is the real way to read the pasuk. You listening? Second way. The Gemara, I hope we get to the Yishalmi. The Hayo Kitim Tseno Saros Rabos Source Aleph, they'll be depressing and it'll be frustrating and God will be obscured and you won't have prophecy for 2,500 years and you'll be in Golos being ported and migrated from country to country. The Ansa Shira Zasli Torah will be a testimony. What is the testimony? How do you know you're still chosen? How do you know in a world of darkness, in a world of suffering, in a world of exile, in a world of anti-Semitism, in a world... What is it? No, it's not Bris Ben Absalom. That was 2,000 years ago. 4,000. It's not Kriyas Yom Sof. It's not Har Sinai. Those are things that are so far. You know what will prove to you? Kilos Yishachach Mipizar. The fact that Torah will never be forgotten. That's the proof. Kilos Yishachach doesn't mean look to the testimony, whatever that testimony is, it'll always be. The testimony is the Torah is everlasting. Do you know how I know we're living through redemption? I'll tell you how I know. Because 70 years after Torah was boulderized and emasculated, and the great yeshivas were incinerated and burnt to the ground, and Torah fell into disarray. 70 years after that, there's more Torah being studied in our world than at any point in Jewish history since the first Beis HaMikdash. Can you imagine that? I asked this question of Rav Lichtenstein, and I asked this question of Rav Shechter just to make sure that I was right. I knew it, but I just wanted to make sure. There's more Torah being studied in 2011 than at any time in history since 800 BC, taking approximate dates. 3,000 years. Not big level, we're not making necessarily the same gedolim we made, but the spread. And by exponential, not by arithmetic, exponentially more. And that's how I know this is a redemptive year. Because Torah hovers above history. It isn't subject to the whims and the caprice. And you can't eliminate it. And I've lived through this, guys. I've lived through the resurgence of Torah. Rav Amital Zichrono Levracha used to tell us he lived through the resurgence of Israel. He was a Holocaust survivor, and he came to Israel and fought in the Battle of Independence, and he marched to the Suez Canal, and he lived through his... I didn't live through that. I came too late. When I was born or reached consciousness, Israel was already a fait accompli. We already experienced all the great wars. I lived through the struggle years. The years of the Lebanon War, the years of terror. There are other miracles and triumphs that I've lived through. Russian immigration, Ethiopian immigration, Israel being converted to economic superpower, which all I all see is divine and prophetic. When I was your age, Torah was dead. I hate to say it was dead. No, yeshivos, great yeshivos, just starting. And summer learning, who learned during the summer, just symbolically? And I felt it because I felt the generation before me. I felt, what do they think? What are they? Sometimes my most powerful learning at night, I apologize if I repeat myself. So when I opened my Zaydi Sefer, Zichrono Livracha, I had two Zaydi, each were big Talmidei Chachamim. But from one Zaydi, I got a lot of Svarim. It's called about 200 Svarim. So I like looking through his Svarim. I see his underlines and his highlighting, and sometimes I find his credit card bills from 1962. You know, his appointment ledger and his left in his Svarim. Not a good idea, guys. You want to pay your bills on time. And all of a sudden it hits me. Why does it hit me? I know, in the back of my mind, that every bit of Torah I'll ever study will probably have airtime. I'll probably teach it at some point. I'll probably incorporate it into a shiur. I'll probably say a joke about it. I'll have to give it over. So that's my motivation. Then I imagine myself living in America in 1955. I thought Torah was dead. He never had a hope to teach Torah. Unfortunately, he never had the chance. There was a rabbi in Europe, and he came and settled into a conservative actual in America. But he just learned. Because he didn't care what the world suggested or promised or whether it would have airtime and people would appreciate his Torah. He just learned. I feel totally humbled when I meet that moment, when I meet him say, I'm so artificial, I'm so insincere compared to you. Because I know in the back of my mind, I'm a Rebbe and I'm going to have to teach people Torah, so it's really not pure, it's only incentivized because I want to be a good Rebbe. And you are just studying everlasting Torah knowing that it would have eternal value, not transient historical value. And all of a sudden, yeshivos and balabatim and dafyomi and MP3s and... It is such an honor to live through this process, guys, and to be part of it. Do you know the time in history you're living through? Do you know what it means to be in yeshiva in 2011 and to have people teaching you Torah and empowering you to love it and to learn it? Don't take it for granted and don't waste it. This is exceptional. This is historical. This is redemptive. This is part of... I'm not telling you... Obviously, in Hezri Yeshiva, we thought it's all part of one composite, learning and serving in the army. But learning Torah is part of our redemption. We won't have a state if there won't be so much Torah being studied in our country. And I lived this pasuk. This pasuk came true. The second you thought it was dead. Then you have a chance, and I'll end with this. Go to the Amsterdam room in the library. Does anyone see the Amsterdam room? It's a side room. If you haven't seen it already, it's right behind the librarian's desk. And it's a shul from Amsterdam, so it's called the Amsterdam Room, which folded about 30 years ago, who knows, 25 years ago. And they donated all their svarim to the Gush Library. So much of their svarim are in those showcases, because they're really old. And they have another section of svarim, like an old room off to the side, it's called the Amsterdam Room. You'll see that room, you'll know it. There are svarim there that are close to 600 years old. That's the oldest svarim. And the youngest sefer in that room is based on the following story, and you can read that sefer. In 1945, there were about 150,000 Jewish DPs, dispossessed peoples, who were in, I wouldn't call them concentration camps, but collection camps, DP camps. And in many cases, they were the actual concentration camps, because where did they have places, you know, areas that had, you know, Tashtit, that had no infrastructure. So they marched right back to the concentration camps. They were denied entry into Chile, into all these foreign locations. It was horrific. Obviously, they wanted the care of the Americans, the Allied forces, the English. So one day, the director of the camp, he was, what was his name? Eisenhower's second-in-command, Joseph McNarty, comes in and calls in the Jewish rabbi, the Jewish chaplain of the camp, and talks to him in Yiddish through an interpreter and says, "What can I do for the Jews? I see they're sullen, I see they're depressed, what can I do?" So Schneik says, "I don't know, what am I going to tell you to do?" And he says, "I have to do something, 150,000 people that walk around like ghosts. I have to do something to replenish the spirit." So McNarty turns to Schneig, Rabbi Schneig, he says, "How about if I empty three German towns? I empty them from Germans and I'll resettle all the Jews." "No, thank you." "Not exactly what we want. It's not going to help us here." Then all of a sudden a light bulb goes off in Rabbi Schneig's mind. To his interpreter, he tells McNarty, "I want you to go to Heidelberg, where they had the nicest printing presses and the best paper. I want you to print the Shas. And to show that Torah is indestructible." It's a very famous Shas. It's called the Holocaust Shas or the U.S. Army Shas. There are a limited number of those sets in the world, probably no more than 100 or 200. We have one set in that library. We inherited it from the Amsterdam Shul. Go read the inscription on the title page of that Shas. It will give you chills. It's a dedication to the U.S. Army for the chesed, for the mercy, for the care they showed. And he thanks the U.S. Army and the Allied forces for helping prove the indestructibility of Torah. When the very land that Torah was under siege, the Jews were an anathema, more or less a paraphrase, Torah has risen anew and is being printed. And who could have known that that shas would end up, or one of those shas would end up on this mountain, would end up in this yeshiva. Or yeshivas like it, but particularly this yeshiva, which to me is such a powerful sign of the renaissance of Torah and the renaissance of the Jewish spirit. Because at once we're trying to rebuild our people, and through it, or rebuild our people through rebuilding Torah. So you're living that. It's unbelievable. You'll tell your children. When I came into a world where Torah was popular, but I had a crazy rabbi of a Torah who told me that when he was a kid, it wasn't so popular. Hey, kids are going to laugh at you. "What do you mean, Abba? Let's get back to Maseches Krisos or something. You know, let's get back to the Kivagor or something. But Abba, in your day, kids didn't finish Shas by the time they were in high school? Nah, come on. Or your grandson will say that. Why, come on." And they'll laugh at you. "Oh, you know, you didn't know how to read the Tosfos." They say, "Well, you see, you know, I grew up in a world, but I made a change. I'm responsible for your world. It's because of me." Just like the fact that you're here, by the way, is because of your parents. You pass it on. That's the sign that we're living through redemption. The last pasuk in Tanakh. The Heshev Levavos Albanim, Velevadim Alevosim, Eliyahu Navi comes and says, and normally, the last pasuk in Malachi, normally, parents pass on a continuous tradition to their kids. But during the apocalypse of Achris Hayamim, things are going to fall into chaos and there'll be fissures in the tradition. And kids will have to restart traditions. Levavos Albanim, Velevadim Alevosim. And they'll have to pioneer efforts where their parents didn't. So a gift from their parents. None of you would be here now if your grandparents didn't keep Shabbos when they moved to England and to South Africa and to America. And your parents didn't wear a kippah or at least show some Jewish. And then you come to, and then your children move a little further. It's the greatest nightmare for me is my kids to be exactly like me. It's like a nightmare. I want them to be so much better than me. And then to look back and they say, "Oh, Abba, you're big on Maritz. But you gave us. You gave us this gift to leap further in Torah." And then my grandchildren look back, "Oh, that conservative rabbi, our grandfather, Rabbi Harrigan, you know, he still listened to English music, I don't know, whatever. He still, they'll laugh at me." Say, "But because of you, so we're able to push the frontiers back." So you're living through history. So that's the summary of tonight's shiur. Religion is duty. Don't shirk it. But don't be overwhelmed by it. It fits. It fits your life. It raises you. It doesn't crush you. But you have to carry it. Not just do what you want. Second of all, love Hashemayim. You're overwhelmed. Start from scratch. Learn halacha. Learn a Tosfos. Learn a Gemara. People got there. you can get there. If you don't get there, it will be through no one's fault / decision but your own. That I can promise you. You will make the decisions, and you alone will determine how far you will go. It will not be a product of anything environmental or biological or intellectual. It will solely be your decision, your outcome. Skills and love. B'fichol b'vavcha. Get the skills, but make sure you hear how much we love it. Make sure you feel our passion. Make sure you're able to become passionate. In general, sometimes people tell me, Rebbe, I don't love learning yet. What should I do? And I turn to the guy and said, well, tell me what you do love. Pizza and the New York Giants. That just shows that at 17, 18, most boys don't know how to love things. You know how to love food, but I mean, how to really be passionate about values that you sacrifice for. Not things that make you feel happy about yourself, but things that you love so deeply. And finally, remember that Psara. Hashem tells us things will look dark, things will look gloomy. But remember, you want to know that you're chosen? This reminds you that you're chosen. This document has relevance every single generation. 70 years ago, you would have looked at the Torah being burnt in the streets of Germany. You would have thought it's finished. 70 years later, 7 wars later, miraculously, all of a sudden, you can't turn around in Israel without finding a new yeshiva opening up. You can't turn around in Brooklyn without finding a new yeshiva opening up.
Let's hope that stops.
No, it should continue. Best, it's all good. Lo si shachach mi kisara. It will never be forgotten. Have a good night, guys.
Is it true that the Gemara now or off
Shabbat?
Wait,
what? 5 minutes ago, actually.
Okay, guys, so let's stop in Marv here. I forgot. I apologize. I thought Marv was later. We're never going to do this. I don't like doing this. On principle, we're davening Marv now. I didn't know that we switched tonight. But we're never going to do this. Just tonight, because I forgot the time switch. אדוני השם לכם עם תיר עקיבא. Thank you.
Thank you.
You now have not only Bashir but Marv as well. Aren't you just so lucky? Whoever this is, I can't remember whose it is exactly. Anyone, whose recorder is this? Anyone remember? What? Oh well, that's life then. No, I don't think it is.